Let the record reflect that it's 1:33 p.m. on this Thursday, March 25th, 2010. We do have a quorum. To my right is Senator Meyer. To my left is Senator Bundy and myself, Senator Pascvan. Senator Thomas is currently having a conflict, but he will be in and out of this meeting as time permits. And Senator Davis has a personal matter that she's attending to, and so is very unlikely that she'll be with us today. Anyway, it is my intention that, a little bit out of order, we're going to take SCR 16, Economic Development Planning Commission, first. We'll likely follow that with the committee substitute for Senate Bill 258, the version R relating to dental care insurance. And then after that, we will address Senate Bill 303, which deals with workers' compensation and contractors. So given that, we would welcome Jeff Stepp, my chief of staff, to present SCR 16.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Stepp, for the record, staff to Senator Pascvan. Mr. Chairman, what I like about this resolution is that it gives us an opportunity to follow through on one of the recommendations of a presentation that we heard earlier in the session back in January, when we had a presentation on overview of economic development in the state of Alaska. And if you'll recall, and it's also in your bill packets, one thing that's universally been identified is that among the state's different economic development initiatives, one thing that is a little lacking is input from the private sector. And through Representative Osterman's office and collaborating with them, the Labor and Commerce Committee has submitted this SCR 16, the main goal of which is to facilitate participation from the private sector in the implementation of state economic development policy. Mr. Chairman, if it pleases the committee, it's going to be my honor to welcome back to this committee Aaron Harrington, who is staff to Representative Osterman. We've been working together on this legislation. She's the one who first made recommendations to this committee back in January. Joining her will be Rob Earle, staff to Representative Herron, who also has been collaborating with us on this. There's a couple things I'd like to explain. First, in our presentation, and I just handed out the PowerPoint on paper. In our presentation, we had anticipated receiving a committee substitute prior to today's committee hearing. It arrived in our office at precisely 1:15, and at that time, I just didn't have time to roll the CS out. The changes we'll talk about here preemptively and have that CS for the committee's consideration the next time this is brought before the committee. There's also reference to the fiscal note in the presentation, and again, we do anticipate a fiscal note because this Economic Development Planning Commission would require some travel and some per diem. We didn't receive the fiscal note in time for the committee hearing, but we'll go ahead and present what we anticipate from that fiscal note. So, Mr. Chairman, if you have any questions, I'm happy to entertain them. Otherwise, I'd like to invite Aaron and Rob.
Thank you. First, I'd like to state that Senator Thomas has joined the committee, so we do have four members. Are there any questions of Mr. Stepp? If not, we'll welcome Aaron Harrington.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, for the record, my name is Aaron Harrington, and I'm staff to Representative Osterman. And I'm honored to be here today. I've been working in collaboration with Jeff on this initiative, and it follows up on conversation that we had had earlier in the session. So thanks for welcoming me before you. And I will just run through SCR 16 with you. So SCR 16 creates an Economic Development Planning Commission. This would be a commission within the legislature. It would be a 10-member task force that would work to integrate some of the ongoing economic development initiatives in the state, to integrate the legislature into those processes. As you may be aware, there are efforts that we discussed in January, such as Alaska Forward and the Governor's Legacy Initiative, that are ongoing. I'll come back to those in a minute. But the idea is to make sure that the legislature has the opportunity to participate in those, and particularly to participate in the implementation of any ideas that are developed through those processes. As Jeff mentioned, there was a CS anticipated, and so my presentation is addressed toward what was expected in that CS, and I'll ask Rob in a few minutes to just describe the differences, if you'd like to know what they are, between the bill that you have before you and the CS. So this commission would report suggested strategies and legislation to the governor, to legislative budget and audit, and under the CS also to legislative council. The commission's activities would sunset at the end of the fiscal year in 2012. The idea here is not to create or replicate any kinds of economic development long-term efforts that might be created through Alaska Forward or others, but to just create a very specific working group within the legislature and in advising the legislature, so that as these processes go along, legislature can be engaged and implement. So what does SCR 16 achieve? First, as I've said, it allows the legislature to monitor these ongoing initiatives. Second, it creates a mechanism, importantly, for the legislature to be collaborating with the private sector on issues related to economic development and to identify places where legislative action is necessary. And if you'll recall, when I spoke to you in January, we talked about the idea of places where a state participation is appropriate. And we said, you know, we suggested from Representative Osterman's work that the state isn't going to necessarily lead economic development, but in many cases it has the tools to support economic development. So as these kinds of recommendations are developed, it gives the opportunity for the legislature to collaborate with the private sector and identify those places for appropriate action. It also demonstrates the legislature's ongoing commitment to the economic development initiatives that are underway in the state, and commitment to assisting with implementation of the ideas or recommendations that are developed through those processes. And finally, it responds to some identified shortcomings from previous economic development efforts. And I think you will likely all have received in your offices from Senator Torgerson a copy of the Alaska Forward Phase 1 report, and in there it is noted that during previous efforts, sometimes things fell apart at the implementation stage, either with the administration or because, you know, the legislative action was needed, but there hadn't been good communication about what that might be. This really tries to address that proactively. So the current statewide processes that are running that we're particularly attentive to are the Alaska Forward process, which has been organized by the Alaska Partnership for Economic Development, and the Legacy process, which has been running out of the governor's office. Alaska Forward has been funded by $500,000 that were given to the Alaska Partnership for Economic Development by the Denali Commission to support their efforts to do a statewide strategic plan related to economic development. They have finished their phase one work. They're in the fundraising and kickoff stage of phase two. And I believe in phase one, they actually spent only about $350,000 to $375,000. So they have some leftover from the initial amount. And I think that they'll be spending roughly twice that on the next stage. And then the legacy process is in the governor's office, and that was established by an AO from the former governor and has been continued under Governor Parnell's leadership. And it is our understanding from talking with the governor's office that that process is morphing and is expected to run alongside of the Alaska Forward process so that they're mutually supportive. And I did notice that there's someone from the governor's office here, or from the Department of Commerce, rather, who's involved in this process if you have any questions about that. There are also other, of course, regional and industry-specific economic development efforts that are going on in the state, and we did provide a slide for you that I'm not going to belabor, but essentially it's pulled from the Alaska Forward report, and you can see from it that there is an amalgamation of economic development entities, processes, groups that are working in the state, and these groups can likely also provide some ideas and thoughts to this legislative commission as its work. kinds of identifies the commission might, or excuse me, kinds of opportunities the commission might identify. We talked again in January about things such as incentive programs. I believe Senator Meyer had some interest in some of those kinds of ideas. We talked about potential tax incentives. We also talked about loan programs, and we can also identify target clusters, economic clusters that could benefit from some additional support or additional boost from state efforts. What the commission will do, importantly, will be to work to draft legislation in advance of each of the two upcoming legislative sessions so that the legislature feels like it can take the feedback of the private sector and the people that are working on economic development and have potential bills to consider during a legislative section so that action can be taken if it's appropriate. We've outlined some ideas about what those things might look like. It could be restructuring of departments, and it could be incentive and tax programs. I think with that, I'll ask Rob to talk a little bit about the appointment structure that's lined out for this piece of legislation.
If we could just interject, I'll ask if there's any questions of Ms. Harrington that anyone would care. Rob, please state your name and affiliation, and then present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rob Rill, staff to Representative Herron. You can see on slide 7 the various appointment authorities for the commission. Finance co-chairs have a large role. The last two commissioners there are just automatically on the commission ex officio. All members would serve until the sunset date. That's why we don't have a term limit on here. It's just a two-year, few-month commission. On the next page, the kind of timeline here, we just received the Alaska Forward Phase 1 report recently. And the commission, the earliest date the commission could start work would be April 30th, although it would probably be later than that. And the first reporting deadline for the commission would be right at the beginning of the 2011 session. And then phase two of the Alaska Forward should be, they're going to be having a summit here in the spring or possibly in the fall. It's still tentative. That'll kind of kick off phase two. And that'll take a while to complete. So we put a second reporting deadline in there before the 2012 session for the commission. And then the commission would sunset in June 30th, 2012. And this next slide, it was interesting. We've had these recent reports from various agencies, and they all seem to be in consensus, Mr. Chairman, that there's a lack of cohesive thinking in economic development in Alaska. And we really think the commission could be a filter and a bridge, taking that information and that's coming from diverse sources and presenting it to the legislature. There's a couple legislators on the commission that could have access to LegLegal and draft legislation, and they could also recommend policy changes to the governor. And just briefly on the fiscal note, that should be forthcoming. It's going to be about $130,000 because there's most of it's commission staff, range 21, step C. And there's some travel per diem there and the assumptions under which the fiscal note was written. And that's the end of our testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I understand it, this report would come to LBNA and Ledge Council. Wouldn't it be more efficient to bring it right to the Labor and Commerce chairs? Why is it going to those entities?
Senator Bundy, through the chairman, thanks for the question. In discussing with Ledge Legal in the drafting of the resolution, essentially the drafter suggested that with LBNA interacting with
the administration on issues related to the budget and the agencies, and then Ledge Council being the policy body for the legislature, that perhaps by presenting to both of those two groups, it would have a broad reach, but that may not be the best idea, and that might be an excellent addition.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the creation of this commission seems to anticipate also then proposing some legislation, and I would seem like you ought to remove filters rather than add additional filters. And perhaps if the legislature is not in session, then Ledge Council would be the route. I really don't understand LBNA's role in this, but legislature's in session. Seems like you're coming in the back door, but again, just my view. Well, if I made an additional...
No, I think that's a point certainly worth considering, and you know, we're looking for the comments of private enterprise and how they can do that, and so I think that Labor and Commerce seems to be appropriately involved in that. So anyway, Senator...
Yeah, an additional question. I hear from people in business enterprise all the time. Is there anything that's keeping these people that would be appointed from talking to their elected representatives? And could they? Wouldn't that be a lot cheaper than the $100,000+ that you're proposing?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I would hope that they would feel free to discuss things with their elected representatives. The concern that this resolution is attempting to address is the one that has been vocalized, that at times it doesn't seem that essentially three stakeholders in these kinds of processes are equally engaged. Sometimes we're told, sometimes in the past the administration and the public have been engaged, but the legislature hasn't been able to be, or the legislature and the public have been engaged, but the administration hasn't. And so I think this resolution seeks to address that concern by assuring that the legislature has a direct route of engagement in implementation of these processes. So I think that's the intent.
Thank you. Well, you're battling the inherent three branches of government, and maybe I'm just a little prejudiced, having come from the university setting where they appointed committees all the time and felt that they'd accomplished something and then blissfully went on their way. So, all right, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bundy. Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the presentation. It's very good. I think, though, in Anchorage, anyway, we have what's called Anchorage Economic Development Association, in which case the legislature are ex officio members, as well as, I believe, the Anchorage Assembly. And I don't know if Fairbanks has...
Fairbanks has an Economic Development Authority as well.
I believe the Valley does, too. So you've got the bulk of your population's already covered by some sort of economic development. There's a whole bunch about the rural areas. So, but I think I see this. I think I see that your intent here is to take all these different groups and have them kind of filter up and into this commission, if I see your vision correctly, because there are a whole bunch of different little associations or commissions already out there. And I guess I share the concerns with Mr. Senator Bundy that, you know, we don't want to set up another commission just to have another commission. So what are your thoughts as far as incorporating some of the local economic development councils?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, I think you raise an excellent point. And the Alaska Partnership for Economic Development, which has been the lead organization on the Alaska Forward planning process, is actually an umbrella organization of these regional ARDRs, or Alaska Regional Development Organizations, of which AEDC is one, and also the Fairbanks entity is one. The Matsu group is one in the southwestern region where I live, the Southwest Alaska Municipal Conference. And it is actually with their initial leadership that the lack of integration on statewide concepts was identified, and that was what led them to the
development of this APED organization and then this Alaska Forward move. The president of AEDC is on the APED board. Marty Mativa from the MATSU RDC is actually the president of APED right now. So this commission is not intended to replace the leadership the leadership of that organization and their statewide vision. It is intended to make sure that they have an excellent not just they, but that the private sector and the groups that are going to be involved in Alaska's long-term economic development have a direct line of contact with the legislature, and moreover have some of the tools and support that would be needed to assist with actually creating legislation where it were appropriate. So.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Myers.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, could I have your phone number and I'll just give them the direct line and I won't charge them near as much. Yeah. Thank you. Never mind.
Anything further that you, either of you, would like to add? Do we have any?
No.
All right. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that, and I shouldn't speak for the maker of the resolution, but I think there's some concern that there has not been as much activity as one would expect when you have a Department of Economic Development and you look around and see what has taken place, and there's a lot of not necessarily duplication of services, but I think that trying to make sure that there isn't a duplication of services and then things are kind of put together on the executive branches, different departments and what they do, so that we don't have different people trying to do the same thing. I see it even in our small interior area. I see we've got several different organizations that exist and they don't work very well together. So mm-hmm. I don't know if this, hopefully this will be helpful in trying to at least figure out why we're not moving forward as a state as rapidly as we could be, and how we kind of put in place not necessarily a list. I'm not saying that's the purpose of this organization, but it may well be something that after being in existence for a while, they see some of the errors of our ways and begin to realize that there needs to be a much better coordination and how that's done. We have a statewide chamber of commerce, but the participation by places outside of Anchorage are limited in that anyhow. So I think it's a good idea. And the concept of trying to put something together that may well bring people together and question why certain things, that would be the biggest part to me, why certain things are not being moved forward and why we're so splintered on the activities. So mm-hmm. just a comment more than a question, I guess.
I would like to recognize Commissioner Curtis Thayer here. I note that he's not signed up, but certainly if you would like to testify, you are more than welcome to do so. We will be bringing this back before this committee once we've had the opportunity to distribute the CS and the fiscal statement and whatever additional thoughts that Ms. Harrington or Mr. Earle would seek to provide to us, and we do thank you for giving us the walkthrough on what the CS will be about, just so that we can better think about that. But given that, I think that it'd be appropriate that we move to the next bill at this time, and thank the two of you for your presentation.
Thank you.
And I do think personally that this, if it's operated as it is intended to operate, will advance positive ways that we can promote economic development, and I think engaging the private sector is extremely important to do here. So I think that we're on the right track is the short statement I want to make.
Thank you.
So given that, we will now kind of get back to Senate Bill 258. Please step forward, and it is my intention that we bring the committee substitute for Senate Bill 258 version R relating to the dental care insurance before us this afternoon. And I would like the committee to note that since the last time we did hear this bill, there's been a lot of work done on the bill by the sponsor and other key stakeholders. And after a presentation of the changes and brief testimony, if it's the will of this committee, I do intend on moving the CS for Senate Bill 258 to the next committee. But I guess first, if there is no objection, I'd like to put the committee substitute for Senate Bill 258 version R before the Labor and Commerce Committee. Is there any objection to that? Seeing no objection, committee substitute for Senate Bill 258 version R is before the committee. And again, we would recognize and welcome Sharon Long, staff to Senator Huggins, to discuss the changes that have been made to this legislation and advance 258.
Okay.
Please state your name and affiliation.
Thank you, Chairman Pascavin. Good afternoon to Chair Pascavin and members of the committee. My name is Sharon Long. I'm legislative staff to Senator Charlie Huggins. Senator Huggins apologizes for his absence, as happens in this building. He's participating in another committee this afternoon, but he thanks the committee for hearing this bill. The CS before you is a result of a lot of work over past weeks since you last heard this bill. The dental professionals, the insurance industry, and small business worked together to clarify the provisions of the bill and craft a compromise which satisfies the original aims of the measure. I particularly draw your attention to a new letter in your packet from the National Federation of Independent Business, Alaska, removing their opposition to the bill. I'm pleased to say members of the Dental Society are here to speak to intricacies of how their new contracts might work, should that be your wish to talk about that. And I think Dennis Bailey, your legal counsel for the legislature, will be available as well.
Yes, he is signed up for questions if anyone on this committee has questions of legislative legal. So
thank you.
Any questions of Ms. Long? Seeing none, we will go to testimony, and we have Dr. John Wohler.
Yes, Senator Pascavin?
Yes, please state your name and affiliation.
Yeah. John Wohler, I'm a general dentist, Fairbanks, Alaska, representing myself and the Alaska Dental Society, both. Thanks for hearing this bill again. Like Ms. Long said, we went through several weeks of reworking it and believe we have a good bill that will benefit actually everybody involved. Basically, what the bill is stating is we're going to add in option for contracts with a dentist to limit fees on non-covered dental services under managed care. Everyone involved will benefit, like I said. Patients with managed care dental insurances are going to benefit from increased access to providers who otherwise nationally are opting out of these contracts when dentists are being forced into an all-or-none situation. A lot are choosing the none. So this bill is going to give the dentist, you know, a lot more options within their practice to incorporate good contract language into individual practice philosophies. Managed care patients are going to be able to stay with their current dentist. It's going to really reduce some access to barrier issues that we're having in the state by not having providers drop out of network. The reworking of this bill is also going to increase the predictability of costs for services from network providers, from dentists who are accepting these contracts. The predictability and the ease of following costs will be easier for the dental patient. Managed care patients also obviously benefit from seeing reduced costs. They do see providers who opt in for these contracts, and with this language in there, we expect to see more dentists opting in. Patients who don't even have managed care are going to benefit from this also, because we're going to see a reduction in cost shifting. A lot of times when we do dental work at cost or health care at cost, you know, you think of an emergency room model, the money doesn't go away, it's just shifted onto other paying patients. And with language such as this Bill 258, we're not going to see that cost shifting. The insurers are going to benefit. The managed care insurance companies themselves are going to benefit because they're going to have a greater number of participating providers that they can market to their audience and have a better product to market. They'll also have an ability to market savings and increase provider participation under managed care plans for those providers who do opt in to fee scheduling for non-covered services. And obviously the dentist benefits from having an ability to join a network without having the insurance company dictate fees for services that aren't being paid a benefit. If they do already participate in a contract, they have a choice to opt in or opt out of a contract that caps fees for non-covered services. So I think after a lot of work through, I'll keep my testimony brief here, but I can see a lot of positives that came out of this. So the Dental Society has full support of that.
Thank you.
That's the end of the testimony.
Thank you, Dr. Wohler. We do have a question from Senator Bundy.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Doctor, it's remote, but the thought occurred to me under the recently passed health care bill at the federal level. Does that include dental care as well? And if indeed it does, how would that impact this legislation?
I've been following along with the health care bill quite a bit and haven't had a chance to read the entire thing, but as far as I'm concerned, it's
that's
not
okay. I don't think many of have read it.
Yeah. I have not seen anything come through on the dental side of it. I think it has been based on medical care and medical insurance. There is some crossover right now between medicine and dentistry, but I don't think it's affecting us.
Okay, thank you very much.
As this new bill.
Any further questions for Dr. Wohler? Seeing none, Dr. Wohler, we thank you very much for your testimony. I saw Dr. Logan in the room. There he is waiting. Please state your name and affiliation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David Logan. I'm a dentist here in Juneau, Alaska, and I'm here representing the Alaska Dental Society. Thank you for the opportunity. I don't want to spend a lot of time revisiting the Dr. Wohler's comments. I thought they were pretty much on spot there. The CS you have in front of you represents a collaborative effort between the Dental Society and the industry, at least those of the insurance representatives we could get to participate with us there. So we're happy to bring this forward to see the CS there and to support it. And rather than belabor that, I'll just ask if there's any questions from the committee.
Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, we thank you. And certainly if there are any issues that might arise, assuming this were to pass in advance the entire way, keep the committee informed as to issues that might arise under it. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. We do have Dennis Bailey from Legislative Legal, who is the drafter of the / R version of 258. He's available for questions if any member of this committee has any need to ask a question. Seeing none, again, it is my intent that we do move this bill to the next committee, so I would entertain a motion regarding the CS for Senate bill. One moment.
Just an add-ease from
the at ease?
Yeah, I don't know.
Appropriately, we need to close public testimony. I assume that there's no one else online or no one else has signed up here. So given that we do close public testimony, thank you, Senator. But anyway, I would entertain a motion to move the committee substitute for 258. Senator Thomas.
Mr. Chairman, I move committee substitute for Senate Bill number 258 be moved to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note.
Do we have any objections thereto? Seeing none, so moved.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman, about how effectively things work when opposing forces get together and craft something that is workable for everyone.
That's true. Well said. So we'll take a brief at ease for Senate Labor and Commerce back to order. Before us now is Senate Bill 303, and this deals with workers' compensation and contractors, and this is a bill that I am advancing, and so if it pleases the committee, I could remain here and present the bill to the committee. The intent of this bill, Senate Bill 303, is to address responsibility and accountability, which I advance are core values that are promoted by Senate Bill 303. I submit that this bill advances conservative principles and fundamental capitalism. It does this by requiring owners and general contractors and others to comply with a basic principle: if you break it, you pay for it. Under this, if an owner or general contractor is 25% at fault, they are only responsible for 25% of the injury damages. I think it bears pointing out that as a nation 250 years ago, we fought a war that challenged the concept that the king can do no wrong. We formed a nation based upon the concept that our government should be responsible and accountable to its citizens for government's wrongful conduct. In Alaska, the general concept has been that immunity of our sovereign is the exception rather than the rule. In other words, governments may be responsible for their wrongful conduct to the citizens of Alaska. When wrongful conduct exists, responsibility and accountability for that wrongful conduct should attach. Senate Bill 303 removes immunity, which protects the privileged from the consequences of their wrongful conduct. And I do obviously anticipate energetic discussion on this topic, but kind of frame the issue from my general understanding of what the purpose and intent of Senate Bill 303 is. And with that, we would, Senator.
If you're open for questions, Mr.
Yes.
Chairman. Having being a veteran of several worker comp vigorous discussions, as you put it, wars, as I how I'd put it, is my understanding accurate in that a while back, I think 04, we said subs have to be responsible for workers' comp of their employees, and the general then is not responsible because the sub is. And your goal is to say, no, subs aren't responsible, the general is responsible for workers' comp. Is that
No. The intent is that each employer is responsible for complying with the law, which means that they must have workers' compensation coverage.
So subs and generals will have
all employers, whether however they might be classified, whether they're a general contractor, first-tier subcontractor, second-tier subcontractor, all employers would remain obligated under the law to purchase workers' compensation coverage.
Does that seem like double coverage in some cases?
The employer is covering each employer's employees. So there is no double coverage in that regard.
Thank you.
Any further questions? We would recommend, or
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'm still thinking on the Senator Bundy's question. So if I'm the general and I hire Senator Bundy as the sub, then who's responsible for the workers? Is it the sub, the general, or both?
The sub is responsible for purchasing workers' compensation coverage for the sub's employees. In other words, that's the short statement.
Okay, so the general's not responsible, but it would be the subcontractor would be the responsible party.
The sub is supposed to purchase workers' compensation, and in part, one of the problems that we have now is that if you have a scam on the system where it's creating unfair bidding practices where the subs are not purchasing compensation coverage, giving them a competitive advantage, you know, that's part of this entire problem that can arise when you give an incentive for someone to not comply with the law by not purchasing compensation coverage. So this, the intent is that the employer has compensation coverage for that employer's employees.
Maybe you can help me, but I thought you also said the general would have to have it.
So for the general's employees. In other words, the...
Yeah, and the sub is not an employee of the general?
The sub is not an employee of the general. That is why they have simply a business contract relationship, not an employment contract relationship.
And current law requires subs to have workers' comp.
That's right. Current law, generally speaking, does require, yes. Okay. But the intent of this bill is to remove the immunity that would apply that if an owner's fault or a general contractor's fault resulted, and that fault meaning that wrongful conduct of an owner or a general contractor were to result in injury to an employee of the sub.
I think I'm getting my hands around it now. The sub or the general will have to buy workers' comp for potential employees, and then by in effect, the general contractor becomes the state agency that enforces his subs to buy workers' comp, because if they don't, it's going to fall back on the general.
For purposes of the removal of immunity, it would not be covered under the workers' comp policy.
I'm sorry to be so obtuse here.
In other words, if there is accountability and responsibility for wrongful conduct, the general contractor's liability coverage would be responsible to the employee of the subcontractor for that general contractor's apportioned or allocated fault.
Yeah, I think I'm understanding what you're saying now, that I'm a general contractor, I employ Senator Meyer, and I don't supervise him adequately, he doesn't have workers' comp, there's an injury, it's going to fall back on me because I didn't enforce state law on Senator Meyer.
We're somewhat talking about two different things here. The question is whether your conduct as a general contractor is wrongful conduct, and if that conduct was wrongful, an employee of the subcontract, and it injured or caused injury to an employee, then your wrongful conduct would be accountable under the law.
Could you title this the Attorney's Full Employment Bill?
You know, I think that it's a citizen's right to redress grievances for wrongful conduct.
And if I might ask one last question. So the problem that this bill is fixing is that some subs buy workers' comp and some don't. And there may or may not be generals that knowingly or unknowingly employ these subs who don't buy workers' comp.
It's more broad than that, in the sense that it removes immunity that currently says that there are privileged or special interests that are not accountable and not responsible for their wrongful conduct that injures someone else.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may, I think there are two situations here. I believe that's what the bill gets at. And one is that you're supposed to have workers' compensation insurance, and you're supposed to post that. We have it in our building here, so it's supposed to be posted. So if a general overlooks those types of things, then in fact the subcontractor does not have workers' comp, then they would be responsible. And the second part of it, as I understand it, is pretty much in reference to, I believe, this legal service opinion number 3, where somebody could be criminally negligent and be exempt from obligation to the injured parties based on the existing statute, and that's what this changes. It's, I think, a couple of examples that I'm aware of, anyhow, where a general contractor actually supervises the subcontractor and indicates that a particular situation is safe because they were the ones responsible for purging a tank, and the tank blew up and someone was killed. In fact, they are responsible. The sub only sent their workers in to do the work based on the general contractor's certification that the tank had been purged or it was a safe working environment. And in fact, it was found that it was not. So that's what it's getting at, those two kind of separate situations. One where no workers' comp exists for the subcontractor, and second where there is a what could be considered and oftentimes is criminal or negligent behavior on behalf of the general contractor beyond the ability of the subcontractor to recognize that or know it, because they were not allowed to be the one that made the decision whether the workplace was safe, because they were not required to go in and perform some kind of checks or hire an outfit even to actually do the work prior to their entering the facility.
If I might,
Senator Bundy.
And just to flesh out my understanding, then in the example you used, the losses probably would have been covered by workers' comp, because assuming the sub was obeying the law, this gives those that suffered a loss another opportunity for recovery.
Correct.
You know, if I could interject, you know, the question ultimately is whether workers' compensation is designed to be a full compensation system, and it is unquestionably not. And under the circumstances, for example, if you have a 25-year-old that's unmarried and he were killed under Alaska's law, workers' compensation law, the total workers' compensation benefits are reasonable funeral expenses. Currently, they're at $5,000. That's the maximum recovery that a family could consider receiving for the death of their son for someone else's wrongful conduct. And I think most people would find that somewhat less than moral. So, anyway, any further questions? I would welcome Trina Hikas.
Good afternoon. My name is Trina Hikas. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Ms. Hikas, you know, I think that you've probably been listening to some of the questions, and I believe that there are some misperceptions of what benefits might or might not be provided under the workers' compensation system and how that might differ from accountability outside of the workers' compensation system. And if you feel comfortable in going through that type of a discussion, I certainly would welcome that.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Passman. Workers' compensation has always required that every employer, any business that hires employees, has anybody working for them, must carry workers' comp. The 2004 amendments didn't change that, didn't add anything. Every employer in the state of Alaska is required to carry workers' compensation. And what developed years and years ago, as long as I did 25 years of litigation for employers and workers' comp before taking this job, and there's always been what's called a subcontractor under clause, and I believe, Senator Bundy, that's what you were referring to, where if the sub doesn't carry insurance, then those above him would have to pick that up. And that just transfers the burden up to ensure that the employees of that subcontractor will be covered. That's one issue. What happened in 2004 was that regardless of whether the project owner or the contractor above that sub has to pay for the workers' comp, they were put in the chain of potential liability. That was the amendment, and therefore given employer status, thereby exempting them from any negligence that may occur on the job site as a result of that. So, for example, there was an incident in 2007, I believe, where two young men were killed in a crane accident, and workers' compensation death benefits were paid, but the estates could take no action against the negligent project owner because of this amendment that was developed in 2004. And what this amendment does is do away with that immunity for negligence. One thing is workers' comp, that's still going to exist. All it's doing is saying to the employee, you'll get your workers' comp benefits, but you'll also be able to sue that third party who caused your negligence. And that's everywhere else in the law of workers' compensation that's allowed. Any other tortfeasor, except in the construction area because of that 2004 change. Now, the workers' comp benefits, the employer in that litigation, let's say it's a subcontractor who did carry insurance, in that litigation against the project owner would get an offset for the amount that was paid in workers' comp benefits. And that's under a separate section. So there's no double recovery in this system. What the 2004 amendments did was, for example, I'm an employee. Senator Bundy, you run into me when I'm driving my vehicle on a normal day, I can sue you in tort for negligence. However, if I was running errands for my employer and you did that and you were the project owner that ran into me or the contractor and this was construction related, I couldn't sue you. My limitation would be workers' compensation. And as Senator Paskman pointed out, it's not a full, that was the trade-off when we developed workers' comp, was that employers would pay regardless of fault, but there would be a cap on the damages. So you don't have pain and suffering. You don't have lost future wages. Once they make medical stability, the disability benefits cease. And we look at vocational retraining or permanent impairment under the Act. So there is limited damages there. Does that clarify?
Thank you. And that was my understanding of the bargain that was made with workers' comp. Everyone's going to pay, but you have immunity from suit because it was a trade-off. If this legislation passes, then I'm assuming that generals will stop buying workers' comp because it's not going to give them immunity from suit or if they don't have any direct employees.
No, they would still carry workers' compensation because under the Workers' Compensation Act, they would still be responsible for the contractor under, as I explained. If their subs don't have insurance, they want to make sure they're insured.
Yeah, so everybody gets the bargain except the general then. The bargain being, we're going to pay, but we're immune from suit. And so we're saying, okay, the workers' comp's bargain is broken for some people.
Well, that's one way of putting it. The other way is that in the construction arena, those injured workers are limited and unable to seek redress for negligence that occurs in the workplace completely.
If negligence occurred with a sub, there would be limited opportunity to seek redress for negligence, would there not?
If it's solely the employer's negligence, that's correct.
So the bargain's broken for some, but not for others.
Well, I don't think I follow you there. The bargain isn't broken. They're not employees of that individual. They're not employers of that individual. The law puts on them an obligation that if you're not policing your subcontractors, then you can be held responsible. So that puts the onus on the contractor to make sure every sub, when he submits a bid, he shows proof of insurance for workers' compensation. And that if he's not doing that, that's a risk he's taking.
If, for example, I think Senator Bundy, in federal contracting, you have to produce certificates of coverage for many types of coverage. The question is that if there is an illegal, I shouldn't say illegal, but a failure to comply with the law, ultimately the question is what should happen in that circumstance? And again, the focus of this is the wrongful conduct of a project owner or a general contractor that results in injury to an employee of the subcontractor. And ultimately the question is whether responsibility and accountability for that wrongful conduct should be the policy of the state of Alaska.
If I might, and it's, again, it's been a while since we've had these discussions. I'm a subcontractor. I have workers' comp. But I do something stupid and injure an employee is injured. That employee gets his worker comp, whatever the benefit is, but then he cannot sue me separately because I've purchased workers' comp.
Correct.
Okay, now I'm a general contractor. There's something happens, there's an injury, they can sue me if I've done something stupid or negligent. So the bargain is broken for generals, but it's not for subs.
I think what you're confusing, though, is that there's no employment relationship between that general and that sub, the employee of the sub.
So,
that's the difference.
Use the technicality and break the bargain, or make sure you employ everybody that works for you. Okay.
If I might add,
sure.
Senator Bundy, ultimately, if the general makes sure that the subs comply with the law and have comp coverage, the general has zero risk of paying compensation premiums because they have made sure their subs complied with the law. The only way that they are subject to accountability and responsibility for wrongful conduct is if they engage in wrongful conduct and it hurts an employee of the subcontractor, hurts someone other than their employee, because this does not change the exclusive remedy provision of Alaska statute in the sense of the direct employer-employee relationship. That exclusive remedy portion of the workers' compensation statute remains the same in that employee-employer relationship. It just removes from the definition of employer those that are not true employers.
Yeah, I understand where you're going. May not agree with it, but I understand where you're going.
Any Senator Meyer?
Yeah, just a couple things. Can we assume then that the administration is neutral on this bill?
Yes, you may. Thank you.
That's kind of been the standard answer. Because I think in 2004 when this came up, it was, I don't know if it was initiated by the administration or the legislature, but there's quite a bit of support both at both levels, the executive level and the legislative level. And to tell you the truth, like Senator Bundy said, I don't remember how this came about and why it came about. All I remember is that it was part of a special session, and it was not pleasant because it was very, very emotional, very, both sides are right, you know, just one of those tough policy calls. But I think that one of the reasons why maybe we addressed this was that businesses or contractors were, they couldn't get workers' comp or it was too expensive, and then they were passing those costs on, and so then the project costs were getting high. Was that part of the reason? And if we do change it, then do the costs go back up?
As I recall, I wasn't involved in that. I was in private practice. But as I recall, it's been explained to me, the reason wasn't motivated by costs of premium. Rather, it was indemnification clauses found in contracts between contractors and project owners. And so a contractor in the middle who has an employee that's injured on the job would pay workers' compensation. And through these contracts with the project owner, where the project owner has put a clause in the contract requiring that the contractor indemnify and hold harmless the project owner for any damages arising out of that contract, then the contractor would have to pay for the employee's workers' compensation losses, and then the employee would sue the project owner, and the project owner would tender the defense and request indemnification in that tort liability. So the contractor was paying both ways, was the motivation behind this. It was my understanding. It was really indemnification language in a contract was what was creating, was the impetus behind this.
Okay, and if I understand this bill, we're not going back to that situation, are we? Or
what? As I understand the bill, if I may, through the chair, Senator Meyer, is that this basically just removes the language that was added in 2004.
We're also, if I might add, we are also looking into the provisions that would declare those indemnification, where you have those at the very top of the economic system imposing in contracts the obligation on those towards the bottom of the economic chain, indemnification, where subcontractor, for example, would say, we will pay for your fault. And I think that there are public policy issues that if someone is at fault, to require someone else to pay for someone else's fault carries serious public policy issues. And you know, there have been changes in Alaska's law, you know, significant changes that have occurred in the last 20 to 30 years that I think need to be addressed, that deal with indemnification, what's called knock for knock issues, and also this immunity issues in light of Alaska's law with respect to allocation of damages. And it's not obviously not my intent to move this bill today. It's just the intent to make people aware of the issues that are important here. And I think that ultimately at the end of the day, to determine whether those core concepts of accountability and responsibility and what I think are conservative principles, if you break it, you pay for it, accountability should attach as a public policy of the state of Alaska. And we're at the very start of this discussion. I think one other point should also be made is that under current workers' compensation law, and Ms. Hykus referred to this and touched on this subject, is the obligation of reimbursement. And if you are successful in establishing accountability and responsibility and recover for that wrongful conduct, the injured employee's obligation under the law is to reimburse the workers' compensation insurer. And the intent of that is to remove the burden from the workers' compensation insurer, which has the sole obligation now for even others' wrongful conduct. and you know, the workers' it's, you know, the question is fundamentally is whether it's fair that a workers' compensation insurer has to pay for a different entity's fault. The intent of this would be is that if it is 100% of, for example, a general contractor's fault, that the injured employee of the subcontractor would obtain future lost wages, pain and suffering, you know, an estate, the spouse can recover loss of consortium, kids can get a recovery for their loss of a parent, and as part of that, the injured or killed employee's estate reimburses the workers' compensation insurance carrier out of those proceeds. And so that, again, is a balanced system, so it is not a, it is not in any sense a double recovery system. And that is why also in the introduction is that if someone is only 25% at fault, they are not 100% liable for damages. They are only responsible and accountable for their allocated percentage. And I think that that is part of, if you break it, you pay for it. But if you're only 25% at fault for breaking it, you only pay 25%. And I think it's a more appropriate public policy.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Meyer.
Just a question, Senator Pascavan, and I appreciate that explanation. And yeah, I'm just trying to understand the bill, and again, just a little gun-shy just because there has been quite a bit of blood shed over this issue in the past. When you say 25% responsible, 50% responsible, I'm assuming that's determined by the courts, or who makes that determination?
The legislature approximately 20 years ago enacted a statute, AS09.17.080, which deals with allocation of wrongful conduct or responsibility for wrongful conduct, and that is ultimately the determination of a jury in the event that there are multiple parties to a litigation. In other words, if there is only one defendant, then obviously the only parties are the injured person and the person that is claimed to be at fault, and the allocation is simply between those two entities. Under Alaska's law, if a defendant believes that someone shares responsibility, should they be found at fault, then the defendant's obligation is to identify that potentially responsible person, join them in the litigation, so that then the jury would have everyone that any party believes potentially should share responsibility is before the court, and then you rely upon the good judgment of the citizens of this state to say who bears what responsibility, again, including the plaintiffs, if there is such an allocation. So it is not designed, this bill is in no way designed to make it easier for a plaintiff to recover. It is not designed to adjust in any way the amount that a plaintiff would recover. In other words, if they are comparatively at fault, they cannot recover for that percentage that might be allocated to the plaintiff. So it is. Thank you, Senator Meyer.
If I can just follow up on that again, and I apologize, I'm not an attorney, and I don't play one on TV or don't know anything really about the occupation. Can I assume then that the jury would not find 100% the general guilt responsible and 100% the sub, so that then the victim in this case gets 200%?
No,
would just be 100% total.
No, yes, that is
25% the general and 75% the sub.
The latter is the only conclusion that a jury can find, and it is under the original allocation of fault statute, there was a provision that under some certain limited circumstances authorized two or more persons to be considered as one entity for the purposes of any particular percentage of fault. That was subsequently removed so that each legal entity that is before the court is responsible solely for their percentage. And so it's, and they can never, answering your question directly, can never exceed 100%. It is the jury's duty to add up the components to equal 100.
Okay. And thank you.
Senator Pascrin, if I could add to that, with respect to the employer, too, their liability is going to be tested in that action. And if they're found liable under an amendment this body passed, I think, in 04, 05, their degree of fault reduces their recovery in workers' comp, so that everybody is stepping to the plate and paying their pro rata share of the fault for these injuries. What the 2004 amendment did to 05-45, though, is just take out everybody potentially liable in a contract or under situation from any ever having to pay for negligence.
Mr. Chairman, as you point out, you won't get more than 100% out of workers' comp, but if this passes, then they have an opportunity to sue in civil court. And then, of course, as you said, the $5,000 for death benefit is maximum. They could get hundreds of thousands if they go into a civil court. So, in a way, there is, it does allow more recovery, but in a different venue.
It is more recovery in the sense that it is the it would be the citizens as a jury's determination of what is appropriate and full compensation, which if you have a disabling injury might include future lost wages, which are prohibited under the Comp Act, which might include, for example, pain and suffering, loss of enjoyments of life. For example, if you like fishing and you can never go fishing again, there is, you know, there is a loss to that, and one may have personal beliefs as to someone else's loss, but it's always very personal to the individual that's lost them. And so it ultimately is a system that relies upon the good judgment of the citizens.
And I recall the McDonald's hot coffee on that judgment of the citizens, so I don't share your confidence.
If I could just add to that, this bill is the only one that prohibits a victim access to the tortfeasor in our litigation system. It gives these tortfeasors a pass. It's what it does. Because of this mm-hmm. employment relationship on the construction site.
I think that's an appropriate consideration to consider moving forward is, again, whether privilege and special interest should be protected or whether wrongful conduct should be held accountable. Any further questions of Ms. Hikas? And we do thank her for this, and we know that I know anyway that she's been involved in workers' compensation law for many years now, and so she is very much an authority in my mind on this subject, and I'm sure she would welcome any questions that any of you may have individually, and certainly I would welcome any of the committee members to further discussions privately or as we do here on the record. So seeing no further questions from Ms. Hikas, we thank you today.
Thank you.
We have Michelle Kale or Kaylee. Is there Michelle Kahle, K-A-H-L-E?
Are you there?
Oh, there we go. We hear you very much now. You are on the record, so please identify yourself and state your affiliation and then provide your testimony.
My name is Michelle Kahle, and I represent myself. I would like to thank the committee and Chairman Pascrin for the opportunity to speak today in favor of the Senate Bill 303. I hope you all understand This is painful for me. So, forgive me if I have to bounce. I'm in favor of the bill because it repeals and rectifies the grave errors, no pun intended, of the Seekins Amendment of 2004. My son Tyler and his co-workers were working the construction project at the Rock Creek Mine in Nome in the July of 2007 summer. He and his co-worker were killed when a man lift that they were in collapsed. The man lift had been set there for over 3 days improperly and unsafe, and all parties that were responsible for management ignored it until it was too late. I'd like to clarify for those of you that may think that my testimony here would help in some litigation. It doesn't. It doesn't benefit us in any way. I feel compelled to share our pain so that some other mother doesn't have to suffer the same in the future. I know this is a real complex issue and a lot of people have trouble grasping all of the different facets of it, and I think that's partly why this Seekins Amendment may have been passed in 2004. And I've done quite a bit of research into this subject, and I found that prior to the Seekins bill, project owners and contractors carried liability insurance, which protected them against liability claims when they were negligent. And post-Seekins, they still have this expense. So their expense as far as liability insurance hasn't changed. Prior to Seekins, employees that were injured or killed due to negligence at work could bring a legal action against all responsible parties except the employer that provided the workman's comp. They were exempted under the workman's compensation law. Post-Seekins, employees have no recourse. They're to be happy with the benefits that work comp provided them, regardless of the negligence of project owners and contractors. And they now are immune from any litigation in the matter, and they didn't even have to buy a workman's compensation policy. I'd like to give you a little background. I'm trying to humanize this a little bit so you understand that the actions of these laws have real effects. Tyler was our only child. He was our life, and he was priceless to us. His life was worth $5,000, according to the Alaska Work Comp Law. That's what we were entitled to. In the fall of 2006, Tyler was only 19 years old, and he was completing his first semester in college. He came home one night, happy as all get out, and announced that his cousin Paul had gotten him a job opportunity in Alaska, and he was going to take a semester off and go to work. We protested like crazy, and we wanted him to stay at home and stay in school, but we knew we couldn't financially help him through college, and we were also afraid that he might find Alaska irresistible and stay there. He said he was either going to go to Iraq or Alaska. Mom, you decide. If your son presented you with those two options, which one would you have picked to bring him home safely? On January of 2007, he smiled a gorgeous smile and hugged us as he was going to the airport. And he said, "What's wrong, Mom? I'm not going to Iraq." And then he came home in a box, just the same. the project he worked on, the owner and the contractor are responsible for safety compliance. On the day of the accident, project manager actually took a picture of the lift at 2:24 p.m. precariously leveled with timbers sitting there for the last 3 days. They obviously felt the positioning of the lift was so dangerous that they felt they needed to take a picture of it. Yet no one bothered to prevent Craig Bagley, my son's co-worker, from going back up in the lift after they took the picture. Tyler innocently entered the lift for just a ride to the ground. He wasn't even working in it. He hooked his safety harness. As they started to descend, it came crashing down, catapulting the men to their death. At 10:30 p.m. Wisconsin time, our phone rang. I answered it. "Hi, bud," expecting our nightly call from Tyler. Instead of hearing the details of his day, I received the details of his death. We were told that we were legally entitled to a $5,000 funeral benefit. That was all they were required to pay. And incidentally, his funeral cost $14,000. Then we found out that all of our other rights to sue responsible parties were no longer there. They were taken away in 2004. We found in Alaska it's cheaper to kill an employee than to train them. I guarantee you it cost the employer and that project owner more than the $5,000 they had to pay for Tyler's funeral to train the remaining staff properly after Tyler died. What incentive is there to expend money to train employees and for management to be safe when they are required to pay for their workman's compensation premiums anyway? Killing an employee due to negligence didn't cost them an additional cent. The contractor who was supervising the quality and conditions of the project was not responsible for anything. The project owner, responsible for nothing. Your 2004 amendment took away employees' rights to sue and for justice. It gave them nothing in return when it took away their rights to sue. Usually when a law is changed and it takes away somebody's benefits, it gives them something in return. This did not benefit the employees whatsoever. It only benefited contractors and project owners. That in itself should have been a red flag. Most businesses today have, at the very least, $1 million worth of general liability insurance. If my son had been killed getting a tour of the project instead of working there, his life would have been valued differently. Why? Is my son's life worth less because he was killed by the negligence at work instead of in an automobile crash? I encourage you strongly to support Senate Bill 303. It repeals these injustices. It doesn't give anybody any more rights or any less than what were in effect prior to the 2004 amendment. And I feel that it's just a jumping off point for Alaska to start looking at other injustices in your workers' compensation laws. In hindsight, I guess I should have picked Iraq. Evidently, it's safer to go to war than to work in Alaska. And until this is changed, employers will not be held accountable, and neither will project owners or contractors. I beg you to support this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mrs. Carl. Any questions? Seeing none, we would call John Lewis from Anchorage.
Hello?
Yes, Mr. Lewis, please state your name and affiliation.
My name is John Lewis, and I'm the president of Ironworkers Local 751.
Yes, please provide your testimony, and if you could speak up a little more loudly. Or
can you hear me better?
Yes.
Okay. In 2004, a bill effectively changed Alaska Statute 2330055 to provide immunity from legal challenges by workers injured while working on the job to project owners and general contractors. Prior to this change to the Workers' Compensation Act, an injured worker retained the right to pursue other companies and employers through legal action as a result of their negligence. One of the outrageous arguments used to push the passage of this amendment to Alaska Statute 2330055 was that it would prevent double dipping by the injured worker. In short, keep a worker from receiving workers' compensation benefits as well as winning in court through civil suit, hence the double-dipping term. In reality, this argument was a red herring since Alaska Statute 2330.15 was already in place and clearly stated if a worker did in fact receive money through court action, any benefits received through workers' compensation would be repaid, therefore eliminating any double-dipping. What this law really did was create a path for general contractors and project owners to cut corners on safety with no fear of financial loss to the victims of accidents, while at the same time still allowing them the ability to sue down or sue subcontractors for the very type of action that they themselves are now protected by this statute. For example, the ironworker industry is one that is affected by enormous workers' compensation rates due to the extreme risk involved. With the way 055 is now written, if an iron worker is hurt by the action of someone else, his employer would now be the one who will bear the cost. One accident could very easily raise the employer's workers' compensation rate to where they are no longer able to compete in the very competitive bidding process of steel erection. Why should the person responsible for an injury not be the responsible person when it comes time to pay for that situation? What is right is that if you cause an accident, then you should be the person who is responsible. Section 055, as it is now written, indemnifies everyone else who may be the true responsible party while essentially shifting the blame or cost to the employer, who very well may have taken every step humanly possible to safeguard their employees. This section of the Alaska statute was formed to provide a clear path for resolution in the event a worker was injured or killed on the job, a means to clearly identify the worker's exclusive remedy was to use workers' compensation insurance to take care of costs to regain their health. Instead, it has become a method for general contractors and owners to push subcontractors to cut corners on safety to reduce their overall costs. I'm not going to accuse anyone of intentionally cutting costs knowing they are going to hurt or kill someone, but I would say that it's easy to cut costs in the hopes that nobody gets hurt. How many estimators do you know that would like their boss to know they save money on the job? I would venture to say all of them. Members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, I respectfully ask for your support in passing SB 303, which would simply restore Alaska Statute 2330055 as it was originally written prior to the 2004 change. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Any questions for Mr. Lewis? Seeing none, we go to Kevin Daugherty, Eagle River.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kevin Daugherty. I represent the Alaska laborers, and I would like to testify in favor of SB 303. I did work back from 1981 on the Ad Hoc Committee for Worker Compensation, also served Governor Hickel's Committee on Worker Compensation in 1990. So I've had some couple decades working in the field. There are three points I'd like to make for passage of the bill, and I think it's very important that we do that. First, you know, our work compensation law has been founded on very traditional values since it was enacted in 1915, back in obviously early territorial days. And I did have LIO fax down, Mr. Chairman, a copy of the message to the legislature by the governor in 1915, if you'd like to look at that history. And I think that history is important because it does state very bedrock traditional values of respecting both employees and employers. And that essentially has been the history until we created this loophole in the year 2004 that exempted people who weren't employers under the, quote, definition that they were an employer. So there was a kind of an evasive definition attached to parties in that case in 2004. So this bill would fortunately close a loophole that never should have occurred in the law. A little quick history, if I might. I was very much aware of the special session that Senator Myers and I think Senator Bundy mentioned a moment ago. I think it was in 2004 on worker compensation, but that went to special session. That was separate and apart from this bill. This one was kind of under the radar. I don't think barely anyone knew about this bill, at least I certainly didn't. Whereas there was a major bill, probably a 20, 30 pager, that Governor Murkowski pushed through in 2004. So I think traditional values have been around since 1915 in worker compensation, and I think this bill would restore that rule of basic equality for all Alaskans to have access to the courts if you are injured or killed, or in the case of Mrs. Kyle, you have a son killed in the job. Second point out of three I'd like to make is, fortunately, the bill would be an incentive for safety. We all know in the real world of construction, any industry, you promote safety by having responsible parties be responsible for their own action. And it's the best tool we can have, and it has worked well. And I'm very pleased to say that if you look at the amount of people that have died on the job or been injured, both of those numbers have come down quite significantly in the past 20, 30 years. Finally, what this bill does is really assure that the definition employer should only be for true employers. You know, these artificial terms that the public would consider deceptive are not forthright, they're not honest to say that somebody is an employer for definitions of the law when they're not the employer. The system we've had since 1915 of having the actual employer be entitled to the treatment and the shield, if you will, or the exclusive remedy, was a good one. It's worked for almost 100 years, now another five to go. But 2004, the amendment was an aberration. I think it was very unfortunate. This bill would correct an injustice that has impacted Alaskans in the last two or three years, and sadly would continue unless we could amend it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Daugherty. If you could provide that historical overview that you referenced, that you have received or you somehow or another have a copy of, I would appreciate it if you could provide that to my office, and then I will distribute that to the Labor and Commerce Committee members so that we can make sure that they have that. Are there any questions for Mr. Daugherty? Seeing none, are there anyone else that is online? No? Anyone here? I mean, we do want to be out of here at 3:15 because we have another committee that's coming in that we need to get ready for. I'm not going to close public testimony, obviously. The purpose of today is just to get the discussion moving forward. I understand it creates a lot of issues, and as I indicated earlier, I'm certainly recognizing it's a topic for energetic debate and want that to continue. So I guess given that, we will conclude Senate Labor and Commerce for this Tuesday, unless there's anything else that committee members. We do meet. For this Thursday. It's not Tuesday. It's Thursday. So anyway, Labor and Commerce on this day is adjourned.